Well, good morning. If we haven't had an opportunity to meet yet, my name is Ben. I'm the lead pastor here at CORE. And for those of you who call CORE home and you have been here frequently, you may be asking the question of why you're stuck with me throughout the entirety of the service. You're used to Josh and Dez being up here at the beginning of service as we walk through games and announcements and all those sorts of pieces. And you are stuck with me this morning because Dez had a healthy baby boy on Wednesday morning. Yep. 7 pounds, 2 ounces. And so 3.5 weeks early, both are doing incredible. And it was an early surprise to their lives and their weeks, but we are so incredibly excited. On top of we count ourselves incredibly excited and privileged that we get to spend part of our morning with you and that you are here as we dive headfirst into part 3 of this series that we have been in that we are calling Winning the War in Your Mind. And throughout this series, we're addressing this topic that is often difficult for us to discuss, be it in the church or outside of the church. And yet, while this topic is so difficult to discuss, what we also acknowledge is that this very topic is one that's practical and relevant to every single one of our lives, that it carries incredible power for the sake of our futures. And that while this topic can be so taboo for us to talk about in our lives, in our church, and in our world, what we also recognize is that this very topic is a topic that centers around something that controls every facet of our lives. You see, throughout this series, we're talking about this topic of mental health and this reality that every single one of us in our lives are fighting a battle in our minds. And whether you're ready to admit it or not, what I can admit about myself is this, is that every single day, oftentimes multiple times per day, that I fight this war inside of my mind, a war full of anxiousness and worry and fear and doubt and insecurities and even depression in our lives and in our stories. And what I've recognized about myself over the course of the last several weeks as we've journeyed through this series is that there are two defining character traits that exist in my life and in my story that often add fuel to the fire of this mental battle that I find myself in. You see, if you know nothing about me, these two character traits that oftentimes define me are these. Number one, I am a perfectionist, who is incapable of being perfect. And a perfectionist who's incapable of being perfect oftentimes lives their life under an incredible amount of disappointment, never fully being able to realize or reach the expectations that they set for themselves. Character trait number two is that I am a self-defined, as I've titled before, this is a made-up word that is really a pessimist. I am a realist. In a world in which there is plenty to find that is negative and hard to swallow and isn't going the way that any of us thought it should go. And as I live my life under those two character traits, what I recognize so often is this. Is that because of those two character traits, I oftentimes feel as if I'm losing this war in my mind. That there is no way for me to get ahead, that there's no way for me to overcome this, that there's no way for me to begin to lose and or for me to begin to win. And that I've just reserved myself to losing and just accepted that this is the way that life is supposed to be, that this is the way that life is going to be now and into my future. And yet the question that I've come face to face with in my own life and what I hope you have as well is this. Is that the way that it has to be? Do we have to reserve ourselves to losing? Do we have to accept that constant worry, fear, anxiety, depression, doubt, and insecurity is just going to be a part of our story and is just going to continue to define us? Or is it possible that we can begin to take back ground from those things in our life? Is it possible that we can begin to fight back? You see, for many of us, the problem exists in this. Is that we've been fighting this losing battle for so long that we've reserved ourselves to not even fighting back any longer. That we've just accepted, much like what I just explained about myself, that there's no way for us to get out from underneath of it. And so we'll just continue to lose and just continue to act like this is a natural part of life for us to be overwhelmed by worry, fear, anxiety, depression, and insecurities. But what if we have a God who no matter what you walked in here with or how you think your story defines you or how far you feel from God, a God who has designed a plan for you to be able to fight back, to take back ground from this day forward in this war that exists in every single one of our minds, be it small or large, to some degree that we fight every single day, that we have a battle plan that's been designed for every single one of us that allows us to begin to win this war in our mind. But if you're anything like me, the question that often rises to the surface is this: how? How do we begin to fight back? Because it feels like we've tried just about everything up until this point, and we are ready to give up, or we've given up long ago. How do we begin to trudge forward and take back ground against all of those negative thoughts in our minds that exist, that affect us? Yes, mentally, but physically, emotionally, and even spiritually. How do we begin to live this life that we were designed to live and that we want to live? Because if you were being honest, what you would admit as well as I is this: we all want to begin to win, don't we? We all want to begin to take back ground. We all want to live a better future and have a positive life. And yet what we've recognized, or maybe we haven't along the way, is this: you can't live a positive life with a negative mind. You can't live a positive life with a negative mind. And so how do we flip the script and begin to take back ground against the negativity that grows and festers and spreads inside of every single one of us? And thankfully for you and for me, the good news lies in this truth: that we have a God who loves us, wants what's best for us, is fighting for us, and has provided an instruction manual for the battle plan of all lives when it comes to this war in our mind. You see, a couple thousand years ago, a guy by the name of Paul began to write out these different steps of this battle plan, recognizing what he was going through, what the people around him were going through, and ultimately what all of humanity would struggle with for thousands of years after he was gone. And he began to provide advice for you and I on how we could fight back and take back ground in this war in our mind against worry and doubt and anxiety and fear and depression and insecurities in every single one of our lives. And here is one of those such places in which Paul provides some incredible hope and some incredible advice. We find it in this second letter that he writes to the church in Corinth. You see, here is what Paul writes. Starting in chapter 10, verse 3. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of this world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension, every lie that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. That last sentence right in there provides such incredible hope. Do you know what Paul is laying out for you and I? That we are capable of taking back control. When he writes, we take captive every thought and we make it obedient, he's saying we have the ability to take back control of our mind. With what? With this divine power that we have been given. You see, a couple weeks ago, we outlined this Greek word that we find in this passage where it's written in English, divine power. It's this Greek word, dunamis. And maybe it sounds familiar. It's the word that we get the English word dynamite. When we look throughout the Gospels, we see this Greek word dunamis come up again and again and again. And do you know how it is used every single time in reference to Jesus' life? We see this Greek word dunamis used over and over again when Jesus is performing miracles on this earth. Correlation moment. Do you know what that means? That you and I, as regular human beings, have been given the gift of this divine power that is the same power that Jesus had when he performed miracles on this earth. For what purpose? So that we could become people who are capable of demolishing mental strongholds in our lives. You see, we've talked about this reality that our enemy, the devil, wants to reshape our minds one lie at a time. And yet we have this divine power that in the midst of him trying to convince us and lie to us that we are trapped beneath worry, fear, insecurity, depression, anxiety in our life, and there is no coming out, this divine power says otherwise, that you don't have the power to lock me in here. That I have the ability to destroy these strongholds that have been holding me back, to burst through and experience something different, something better in my life for my future. But the rub that all of us experience is that within our lives, scientifically within our brains, we all operate mentally with something called a cognitive bias. The cognitive bias is simply this. It exists in all of us as we move through life, and it continues to grow as we experience or live more life here on earth. You see, a cognitive bias, scientifically, is simply a mistaken reasoning based on personal preferences or experiences. That as we move through our time here on earth, every single one of us begin to develop, dare I say, a mental filter or a mental framework that we begin to assess or look at everything in our life through that frame or through that filter. And that filter is developed by the things that we've experienced in our lives and our past, the preferences or beliefs that we've been taught as we've grown up. And as we move throughout our life, this is, right, the obvious. As we move through our life, we accumulate more and more cognitive biases because we have more experiences, which means we have more things to filter every circumstance of our life through because we've been through something similar to that in our past, and we know it's going to turn out that way in our future. And to just give you a moment to get off the hook, I mean, let's be honest about this. There are a lot of cognitive biases that we operate beneath within our lives that aren't even our fault. For some of us, we grew up in a house in which every time we encountered or we talked about wealthy people, our parents always talked about wealthy people in the same way. That those people were snobs, that those people were arrogant, that we wanted nothing to do with them. And now here you are as an adult, and you carry that cognitive bias with you. That every time you encounter or talk about a wealthy person from a particular town, you go through that exact same mental process in your mind. That you begin to immediately associate that those people are arrogant snobs as well. Or maybe for you, you were abused as a child. And now you grow up, and any time you get physically or emotionally close to a man, your mind automatically reels back to that. And you begin to operate under this belief that every man is an abuser. And I don't know that I can trust any man because I couldn't trust that man. You see, for every single one of us, we have scenarios, experiences from our past that add to our cognitive biases. And ultimately, they create a lens that gives us a distorted view of reality. It may be slightly distorted, it may be majorly distorted, but our experiences and preferences create this distorted lens in which we view everything just slightly off 100% accurate. Not completely as it is because of our own experiences, what we've been told, or what we've walked through in our lives. And you see, if we looked close enough and got honest enough, what we would typically find is that it isn't the facts that affect the feel, it's the filter that affects the feel. It isn't the facts that affect the feel of something. Ultimately, it's our filter that affects the feel. And the reason why I know this and you know this is because we have encountered undoubtedly tons of experiences in our lives in which two people can look at the exact same thing in two totally different ways. Am I right? Two people could walk through the doors for the first time of Core Community Church, a husband and a wife. One person could walk in here and they could say, man, this place feels as if it's so full of hope and it's full of kind people. And the second person could walk through those doors and immediately all they see is judgmental hypocrites. Hang on, y'all. I'm about to go deeper. Two people could look at something like a vaccine and see it in two totally different ways. For one person, the vaccine looks as if it's the solution to everything bad that we've been experiencing over the course of a couple of years. For another person, they simply see it as governmental propaganda. You see, it's not the facts that ultimately affect the feel. It's the filter that we bring to the table. How we've grown up, what we've been told, what mainstream media outlet we're watching. That all of us bring this cognitive bias, this filter to the table. And it reminds me of this incredible story from the Old Testament. That as we look at all lives and this reality, that we get to choose how we look at things, how we look at the experiences of our lives and what we're encountering. There's this incredible story. We find it in the book of Numbers. It happens as the nation of Israel has been released from captivity and they're getting ready to enter into the promised land. If you know nothing about this part of the story of the nation of Israel, I'll bring you up to speed as best as I can in about 30 seconds. You see, the nation of Israel had been taken as slaves to the nation of Egypt. And they had found themselves as slaves for several hundred years until a guy by the name of Moses was asked to go and free his people. And so he goes to Pharaoh and he says, "Let my people go." And he continues to say, "Let my people go," until Pharaoh finally relents and says, "I'm tired of all this trouble. Get out of here." And as they're released from captivity in Egypt, there is this promise to them that there is this land that will once and for all be their own. This promised land that they will enter into that will become theirs and theirs alone. And yet what the nation of Israel finds is that they find themselves wandering for 40 years trying to find this land that had been promised to them. This future that they had desired, this dream that they had had. For 40 years, they were lost in the wilderness searching for this until one day they find themselves on the doorsteps of their promised land. And their leader, Moses, gets this bright idea. As we find ourselves on the doorstep about to enter in, I'm going to send out 12 spies. And I want these 12 spies to give me their assessment of what this promised land is like. And as he sends out these 12 spies, 10 of the 12 spies come back with a negative report of the promised land. Everything is too big there. The giants are too big. There's no possible way that we could possibly take this land as our own. We might as well just move on now and find another land and put this promise from God behind us because this isn't possible. This isn't going to end well for us. But 2 of the 12 returned back with nothing but a positive report. "You've never seen grapes this size. You've never seen a land like this. Can you imagine us getting called this our own? What a blessing this is from God. We've got a good God. We shouldn't turn back and run. We should charge in there and take this for ourselves right now." You see, it was the exact same land looked at from 2 totally different filters, 2 totally different cognitive biases, that they made a choice in that moment of how they were going to look at their life. A choice that you and I are faced with every single day. About 7 years ago, literally to the month, Krista and I had been here at CORE for a little bit over a year, and we had gone through the process of retooling and rewriting our vision and our mission and our values. We were set in a new direction, and with that, we believed that with that, some of our ministries needed to begin to shift, and our strategies needed to begin to change. As we had this vision for what God was calling us to and this huge dream of reaching further into our city and further into our world and being a church for the lost that actually calls found people to more, not less, that with that, our global impact strategy had to change as well. That we wanted to become a church that within our global impact strategy was committed to this reality of it being about relationship first. About what it looked like to empower people who are doing the work boots and work gloves, the blood, sweat, and tears right there in their own city, in their own country, who knew their people had a heart like ours, but could do it in an incredible way that we just couldn't in their country. And could we be a push from behind them? Could we be a support from behind them? Not being the people who come in and say, "We're going to paint your church like you don't have painters in your country," who it would actually benefit your culture and your society for us to just pay them to paint it for you. No, we wanted to be about relationship and empowering people who were feet on the ground. And we had a contact through Krista. She had done multiple trips through an organization called AIM, and they had partnered in Africa with multiple care points, an organization called Children's Hope Chest. And we went through multiple phone calls with Hope Chest, and we began to learn more about their vision of this empowerment strategy and about relationship first and about child sponsorship that was about going and spending time with kids and families and loving on them and empowering the CarePoint directors within that country and that city to be able to share the hope of Christ and change their world in an incredible way. And as we began to hear this vision and its alignment with ours, we were like, we're all in for this. And as we said, we're all in, they were like, all right, in 2 weeks, we're going on a vision trip. You guys in? And so we booked the flight, and we're like, I'm the only one on staff, so we got to go Monday to Friday. We booked a flight out Monday, a flight back Friday. And in our time on the ground in Guatemala, the plan was simply this, that there are these care points throughout the country of Guatemala, and every day you're going to go visit multiple care points, and then you're going to select which care point you believe really aligns with your church, and that's going to be the care point that you partner with. And so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we were at multiple care points every single day, and you'd get off the bus and you'd have time to play with the kids and the families at the care point, and then you'd sit down and you'd get to meet the care point leaders and directors and hear their heart and their vision and their struggle and how they needed a push from behind and where that push was needed. And on Wednesday, we got off the bus and we had traveled a long way to a rural location. And there were already things pinging for us, like here we are, rural location. It kind of jives with Shelby, Ohio, right? A little bit out in the middle of nowhere. And we got off the bus in this rural location in this city, this village, where literally we learned they had to go 4 miles each way for access to clean drinking water. They would carry 5-gallon buckets, and they would fill up with clean drinking water. Can you imagine that? 5-gallon buckets for 4 miles, and then they would ration their drinking water for as long as they can within their households before they would have to walk back 8 miles round trip to get 2 more buckets of water. And yet right smack dab in the middle of this was this care point that was absolutely pristine. It was so incredible. Beautiful facilities, an incredible dream. They had this vision where they were going to bring a cistern in and they were going to provide clean drinking water right there in the middle of the village for all of their village. We got to play with the kids, and we got to hear this incredible vision, and they were already so far down the road and what they were accomplishing. And we climbed back onto the bus, and Krista and I were like, that was awesome. I think we're in for that one. And as we climbed back on the bus, there were like 4 other pastors. We were like, that was awesome. We're in for that one. And our drive back to Guatemala City, it was like, okay, how do we figure out who's got dibs on this one first? And we rolled up to our second care point, right smack dab in the middle of Guatemala City. One of the poorest neighborhoods in the entire world. And we climbed off the bus and we waited and waited and waited and waited until finally a lady came out and got us, and they walked us down the street to what was a public school. And there was a room that wasn't being used upstairs, and so all of us on the team walked up there, and there was a lady, the care point leader, that was sitting there. Her name was Jamada. And she began to talk, and she began to outline sort of the struggles that they were under and the circumstances that they were in that were putting them into disarray. You see, they were presently renting a government building, and what that means in Guatemala is this, is that when the government building is closed or people decide to go home early, you got to be out, and you got to be out now. Your services stop for the day. It doesn't matter. We're leaving early for the day, and so you're out on your butt, and everything you're doing in the care point stops immediately. And on that particular day, the government building had shut down early, and so there was no place for us to go to see what they were doing, to see the kids, anything like that. And so we listened to her talk and all the struggles that they were under and how far they were from where they wanted to be. And then we had to walk down the street to a playground because we couldn't even play with the kids there on site. And so we had some of the families come, and we got to play with the kids. And we walked back onto the bus after this visit, and you know what we heard? Crickets. And it was this moment in life where Krista and I sat down in our seats and we looked at each other, and it was like this voice from God, not like the audible voice, right, that may creep you out, but it was clear as day. We looked at each other, and I try not to get emotional. We looked at each other, and almost at the same time we said, no, that's the one. That's the one for us. That's the one that resonates with our heart. And from that day forward, within all lives, within our ministry, within this place, maybe y'all have heard me say this countless times, that there was sort of this new rallying cry that I believe we needed as a church and we needed as a couple. We needed in our lives and our ministry. It was this reality that in every challenge of our lives, we get to choose whether we see the impossibility or whether we see the opportunity. In every challenge of our lives, we get to choose whether we see the impossibility or whether we see the opportunity. And on that day, we were all in on the opportunity because what we saw was this. Can you imagine over the course of the next 7 years what we're going to be able to see in and through this place? A care point that started in absolute disarray that didn't have a place of their own, where Core Community Church over these 7 years was able to donate $50,000 for them to buy their own building to do care point and work. A building that over COVID in Guatemala City, if you were on the streets, a population that we serve that's largely homeless, you would be arrested and thrown into jail. And they immediately shifted our care point into a homeless shelter for those homeless people to feed them and house them and give them a place where they wouldn't be in trouble with the law. The growth that we've seen and the change and the hope of Christ slowly spreading in a city was because we had a choice in how we were going to see things. Would we look at the impossibility or would we look at the opportunity? You see, that, y'all, is reframing. And every single one of us in our daily lives and our daily circumstances have a choice of whether we will choose to purely operate under cognitive bias or whether we, in this war in our minds, will operate with a tool of reframing. That we create a different way of looking at a situation or a relationship by changing its meaning. That the way in which we step back and look at our day, look at our lives, look at our circumstances can be different when we choose to look at it differently, change its meaning, to look for the opportunity, not just the impossibility. See, for many of us, our day, month, year, life, looks a whole lot like this picture. And if you're anything like me who's fighting perfectionism and is a realist in his life, many days when things don't go exactly as you planned it to go, or even when they do, it has become natural. When we talked about this 2 weeks ago, this neuropathway that I've created in my life, and the more times I go down that negative neuropathway, the more it becomes my default pathway within my brain, the more it becomes natural for me, in light of my entire life and the big picture, for me to frame my life like this. For me to only see the storm clouds of my life and the things that haven't gone as planned and the ways in which I've failed and I'm not enough and I'll never be enough and I'll never measure up to the perfectionist expectations that I have. And I've struggled through this and I've struggled through that and it just isn't fair. When all the while I miss the reality that within the battle of my mind, I get a choice. This is the scope of my day, my week, my month, my life. And will I choose to place my frame in the storm clouds of life? Or will I choose a different picture? Will I choose to see something different? Will I choose a new neural pathway that puts to bed the negativity and is willing to step back and see that there's something more to the picture of our lives? You see, the fact of the matter is simply this, y'all. We don't control what happens to us. There are a lot of things within our lives and our stories where we don't get to control what happens to us. But do you know what we get to control every single time? We get to control how we frame it. You don't always get to control what happens to you, but you always get to control how you frame it. And for you, you might have walked into this place and your life, quite honestly, isn't where you want it to be. You've tried everything possible and you haven't been able to turn things around. You feel lost and buried beneath this mental struggle. against worry, fear, anxiety, stress, doubt, depression, insecurities in your life. Here you sit and you're 50 and single again. You're 30 and all you've been is single. And it feels like you're always the bridesmaid and never the bride. You find yourself stuck at the same level of your company that you've been in for the last decade, always getting passed over for the promotion. You find yourself in a place in which it feels like everything you try never helps you get out of that financial pressure or debt that you feel yourself under. There's this constant financial worry and stress that you operate under every single day. Or maybe you're dealing with a medical diagnosis. A diagnosis that leaves you and your family buried beneath a whole bunch of uncertainty in your life and what your future looks like. If you find yourself in one of those places, and if there was anyone who understands where you're at and what you're going through, it was this guy that we talked about earlier, Paul. Because Paul gave his life to ministry and this mission of helping people see and understand the hope of Jesus Christ and the transformational power that he brings to all lives. And yet in giving his life to this mission of sharing Jesus with as many people as possible, you know what Paul was met with at every turn? Just to give you a snapshot, Paul was met with shipwrecks, being snake bitten, beaten, flogged, and thrown in jail more times than what we can count. And in this small snippet of this letter that we're going to read in just a moment, this letter that he writes to the church in Philippi, most scholars believe that Paul writes this letter as he is imprisoned in Rome. And that's significant, and here's why. Because Paul, what we know about Paul is that Paul had this dream. This dream that one day he would get to go to Rome. And if you know anything about ancient Roman history, Rome was the capital of the Western Roman Empire. It was the place where all the bigwigs resided. If you were anyone, that's where you lived. All of the major government officials and powerful people lived in Rome. And Paul had a dream that one day he would go to Rome and he'd be able to share this hope, this love of Jesus and the transformational power. And he would begin to share this. And the government officials of Rome would begin to see this love of Jesus. And they'd begin to buy in and enter into a relationship with Jesus. And the Roman world would change on the back of Paul marching into Rome and sharing this love and this hope of Jesus. And Paul got to go to Rome. Oh, Paul got to go to Rome. Paul got to go to Rome in chains. Paul's first visit to Rome, he was chained to another Roman prison guard. 24 hours a day, every 8-hour shift, a new stinky guard was chained to him. He was thrown into prison unsure of if he would ever get out. His dreams crumbling before his eyes. This is not how he drew it out, not how he wanted it to be. And yet this was Paul's reaction in the middle of seemingly unfair circumstances in his life. He wrote this. And I want you to know, my dear brothers and sisters, that everything that has happened to me stinks and is unfair. Because of what happened to me, I'm quitting small group and I'm never going back to church. That was from the new Whiners, Complainers, and Pessimists version. Now, this is actually how Paul reacted. And I want you to know, my dear brothers and sisters, that everything that has happened to me here has helped to spread the good news. For everyone here, including the whole palace guard, knows that I am in chains because of Christ. And because of my imprisonment, most of the believers here in Rome have gained confidence and boldly speak God's message without fear. Because of what happened to me, the gospel is spreading. And y'all, you want to talk about prisoners? I get a new prison guard chained to me every 8 hours that doesn't know Jesus, that has to listen to me for 8 hours, tell them about the hope and the love of Jesus. That's a ministry, y'all. That's purpose, y'all. That's a calling, y'all. You see, Paul had this innate ability to reframe in his mind how he saw the circumstances of his life. This is reframing to a T. and we have that same ability. We get that same choice, but the same question arises. I know, how do we do that? Where do we start? How do we begin to eradicate these negative thoughts and change the place of our frame, of our mind, and how we look at our lives and everything that happens in our lives? Well, I want to finish with three simple things. Three simple things that we can do in our lives that will help us get in the habit of reframing. The first is this, is that within all lives, there are times in which we need to step back and thank God for what didn't happen. I heard this story of this young girl. She came home from Christmas break after her first semester of college, and she walked in the front door, and she looked at her parents and said, "We need to talk." They walked into the living room, and she sat them down on the couch, and she began to tell them this story. "When I went off to college, I met this boy, and I was immediately enthralled with him. We began this relationship, and one thing led to another. And what you need to know is that I'm pregnant. And I actually didn't meet this boy on college campus. He was from the town that our college is in, and he had just gotten out of prison. He finds himself on parole, but he promised me that he would get a job, and that if I wanted him to, he would marry me, and so we're going to get married." And as the disbelief and the shock washed over her parents, she allowed the silence to hang there for a moment. And then she burst through the silence and she said, "Actually, none of that is true. I got a D in my freshman algebra class, and I just wanted you to know how bad it could be." See, sometimes in our lives, we have to step back and recognize that even when circumstances are bleak, man, look at our care point. There's a group of over 200 kids, 200 families that come to our care point every single day that don't know where their next meal is coming from. I don't know about you, but I'm guessing that's not a reality that you struggle with on a daily basis. But sometimes it requires maturity for us to step back and to recognize, yeah, things are bad, but here's what didn't happen. Here's how it could be worse in my life. That you step back and you recognize that things would drastically change in your mental state and my mental state if we were capable of thanking God every once in a while for the things that didn't happen. Secondly, we practice pre-framing. We talked about reframing in our lives and in our thought process. What we don't recognize is that so much of our mental state stems from a choice. And here's the crazy choice that we get. You get to choose how you see a situation before you even enter into the situation. Y'all, you all have experienced this most likely with your in-laws. Not my in-laws, just your in-laws. There's been that Thanksgiving get-together where all the crazy aunts and uncles from your spouse's side are getting together. And you have dreaded that Thanksgiving get-together for days, if not weeks. You know just how terrible it's going to be. And you don't want to encounter crazy Aunt Susie and all the things that she has to say and her opinion on everything about you and your kids and how misbehaved they are. And you go in expecting how bad it's going to be. And then you show up at the Thanksgiving get-together. And how does the Thanksgiving get-together turn out? Terrible, right? You set it up in your mind that it was going to be terrible, and it turned out terrible. There's that work meeting that you have every single month that you dread. You're leading it, and you don't know how to lead it. People come in, and they don't pay attention. They don't listen to what you have to say. You sit through that meeting. It's boring every single time, and you dread it every single month. And as the meeting approaches, you just don't want to go. And then you walk into the meeting, and what does the meeting end up being? Just as terrible as what it always was. You see, what we often miss in our minds is what you get out of a situation is ultimately determined by what you put into the situation, how you walk into that situation. And sometimes we need to practice pre-framing, that we just don't immediately, before we enter into a situation, go to the negative and think about how bad it's going to be and dread it all the while. That we turn our thoughts and we take back captive, as Paul talked about. We take back control and we say, I'm not going to see just the negative. I'm going to look for the positive. I'm going to look for the glimmer of hope. Or I'm just going to clear my mind and I'm not going to think about anything before I go to this Thanksgiving get-together and just let it turn out the way that it's supposed to turn out. In our lives, we practice pre-framing because we recognize ultimately the outcome is determined by how we walked into that situation. And then third, we look for God's goodness. You see, newsflash, you will always find what you're looking for. And if you go looking for the negative, I don't know if you've recognized this yet or not, but we live in a world in which you don't have to look far to find the negative. But what I also believe with all of my heart is this, is that if you go looking for the positive, we also live in a world in which it isn't hard to find that as well. That we have a God who is good and loves you and is for you and wants what's best for you. A God who wants you to experience a rich and satisfying life on this side. A God who has gone to work trying to fix what isn't right. A God who walks through the difficult circumstances and the darkness with you. But the question is this. Are you a vulture or are you a hummingbird? You see, when you think of a vulture, every single day a vulture ventures out and what do they find? Dead things. Why? Because that's what they're looking for. But when you think of a hummingbird, every single day when a hummingbird ventures out, what do they find? They find the sweet stuff. Because that's what they're looking for. You never find a hummingbird vulturing over a dead carcass. Because they're not looking for that. They're not interested in that. They're not going there. And so when it comes to all lives and every day that we have left on this earth, will you choose to look for the dead stuff? Or will you choose to find the sweet stuff? It exists all around us. The question is, will we look for God's goodness that is there, has always been there? God is good, y'all. God is good. It wasn't planned that we would sing that song right before the message. All my life, he has been faithful. All my life, he has been so, so good. He pursues us when we don't deserve it, offers us grace and forgiveness when we were far from him. A God who always has been, always will be good, who comes through on his promises every single time. If we look for God's goodness, we will find it. And y'all, there was no better opportunity than what we've walked through over the course of the last 3 years. See, 3 years ago, we entered into COVID. As we ventured through COVID, if you were anything like me, it felt like everything was terrible. For like 2 straight years, all we experienced, lockdowns and quarantines and new regulations. Feelings of, will this ever go away? And there was this thought in the middle of all of it, that there is nothing good that could possibly come from this. Can we just get past this? Can we just get over this? Can things just go back to normal? This is all bad. But if we step back, was it? Or was there an opportunity, even in that, for us to choose something different? You see, I don't know about you, but for me, when it came to my life, my family, my marriage, if I would have been serious about it, COVID was an opportunity for me to refocus my priorities, to be able to see the things that I was thankful for, that I had my health, that I had my family. There are these freedoms that so often we take for granted every single day. There was this question around this place 3 years ago when we shut down and we didn't do service together for almost 3 months. And then we came back and we were doing three services plus programming an online service that was different from our Sunday morning service to broadcast out there. And numbers declined in a huge way. Would we ever get back to normal? Would things ever go back to the same? How much is this going to hurt us for forever? And yet, y'all, we have a good God. We have a good God. A God who has always been there, always been for us, always fighting for us. A God whose heart is about lost people, and even when things get difficult, if we join in his heart, he does more than we could expect. He takes us out of the storm clouds and produces something better, something more incredible in our lives and in our future. But we have to be looking for it, y'all. You see, it's like this passage in the Old Testament. In the first 11 verses, this guy named David, one of the greatest kings in all the nation of Israel, outlines all of these terrible things that are happening in his life and his world. I'm being attacked from every side. People are saying terrible things about me. It seems like my life is falling apart. And then we get to verse 13, and things change in a drastic way. This is so good, y'all. Check out what he writes. For I would have lost heart unless I had believed that I would see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. With everything happening around me, I would have lost heart. I would have lost hope unless I trusted that I would see the goodness of God right here, right now, in my life, in my circumstances, in my world. At some point, the turning point for all of our negative thoughts rests on this choice. That we make the decision to stop interpreting the goodness of God through the lens of our circumstances. And we start interpreting our circumstances through the lens of the goodness of our God. And when we do that, and we take back the frame, and we make the choice of where we're going to place the frame in our lives, that we're going to thank God for the things that didn't happen. We're going to practice pre-framing before we even walk into a situation, and we're going to look for the sweet stuff. We're going to look for the goodness of God that exists all around us if we're just willing to look. Those are the moments, y'all, where in spite of the negative thoughts that swirl, we begin in a few small, simple steps to win the war in our mind. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, we thank you for your goodness, for your pursuit, for being a God who loves us, wants what's best for us, a God who knows us best and yet still offers us what we don't deserve, a God who walks through the trials and the hurt and the darkness of life alongside of us. A God who knows the mental struggle that we all battle in our lives. And a God who gives us a battle plan to fight back. God, on this day, may we be courageous enough to take a few small, simple steps to begin to reframe. To not just do things the way we've always done it and adhere to the cognitive biases that exist in our minds and in our lives, but to reframe. To thank you for what didn't happen. To pre-frame before we walk into a situation and to look for your goodness at every turn. God, when we do that, we thank you that your promises always hold true. That we can take back captive our thoughts. We can break through strongholds and begin to win this war in our mind. We thank you for that. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.